Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and let's dive right in with our week in review. Former Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown is inching closer to a Senate run in New Hampshire.
He has a quality of star power, and I think that he brings a level of excitement to the race.
Back here in Massachusetts, a new push and an old debate to raise the minimum wage.
Massachusetts is very much a part of the national discussion on wages. Workers here as elsewhere deserve a fair wage.
And with the Boston Marathon just weeks away, public safety officials announced new security measures for this year's race.
We want the right balance of security and celebration and fun, and that's exactly what these public safety officials are trying to maintain.
Plus, a new report by the Child Welfare League of America calls for changes at the Department of Children and Families.
We've already done some work to enhance our staffing and to begin the process of bringing new technology into the department.
So lots to discuss in our week in review, and joining us to do so is Jim O'Sullivan, political reporter for the Boston Globe and Boston.com. Hi there, Jim.
How are you?
I'm doing well. Also with us is John Carroll, communications professor at Boston University. John, great to have you back.
Always nice to be here.
All right, let's jump right in with former Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown, who could become New Hampshire Senator Scott Brown. After months of questions, will he, won't he? This week he set up an exploratory committee for a possible run in the Granite State. We understand that Fox News has terminated his contract. He's also recruiting a campaign staff. And today in Nashua, he's appearing before the Northeast Republican Leadership Conference. So we should mention, by the way, that former Republican Senator Bob Smith is also running for the Senate in New Hampshire. Today he challenged Scott Brown to 10 debates. But Jim, let me start with you. Let's assume that Brown gets the nomination. He'll be challenging Democratic Senator Jean Shaheen. She's a centrist. She's been beaten before in that state, which is a bit of a swing state. Right. Do you like Scott Brown's chances in New Hampshire?
I think Scott Brown is a very strong export to New Hampshire. His brand of politics, which is a little more centrist, he's, you know, since he lost to Elizabeth Warren, he's been going around talking about how the Republican Party needs to have room for folks who are like-minded with him, as well as folks who are more conservative, like Rand Paul. So he sort of preaches a big tent Republican Party. That said, he's going to have to deal with the carpetbagger thing.
And, right.
You know, Granite Staters are fiercely protective of their political prerogative, the whole first in the nation idea, and it sort of remains to be seen how they're going to, how the base, the Republican base, as well as the independents who swing elections up there, are going to sort of cotton into the idea of this guy coming up from Massachusetts.
Yeah, what do you think, John?
Well, I think sometimes the big tent in primaries becomes a kind of a small tent, and the Tea Party activists could have a sort of disproportionate effect on this. I think one thing you're not going to see from Scott Brown is a people's pledge this time around. Hmm. That's kryptonite to him, though. It was a big tactical error in 2012 against Elizabeth Warren. I don't think you're going to see that. I think we're going to see something that is going to be really ugly and really expensive. There's already been over $1 million spent by outside groups already on this race. They were attacking Brown before he even decided to jump in. Beyond that, Karl Rove's American Crossroads Group is launching a $600,000 ad campaign starting next week up in New Hampshire. It'll run here in Boston as well. So this is going to be a real knockdown, drag-out battle.
Well, let's talk about this this potential carpetbagger label that Jim brought up. Here is New Hampshire Democratic Party Chair Ray Buckley speaking recently on NECN about a Scott Brown run for the Senate in New Hampshire.
I don't think anyone who has lived in New Hampshire for more than a couple days believes that Scott Brown is from New Hampshire. He can say that he is, but he really is not. New Hampshire doesn't represent New Hampshire values.
Now, in fairness, Scott Brown does own a home in New Hampshire, but John, I'll stick with you. Do you think the carpetbagger charge can stick?
I think he can stick, actually. I think that he's going to have to go a long way to convince New Hampshireites that he's not just an opportunist crossing the border to get a Senate seat that he couldn't retain here in Massachusetts. He's got another problem beyond that, too, and it's about gun control. He supported an assault on a federal ban on assault weapons in 2012. I think that's going to come back to haunt him, too.
Interesting. But, Jim, obviously there's going to be a lot of national attention on this race. John talked about all that outside money that will likely pour are in. I mean, I would think that the Republicans really see this as a potential here for part of their effort to take over the Senate.
Right, absolutely. And I think John made a good point with the idea that New Hampshire folks won't be that receptive. Let's not forget that he's also sort of been flirting with this idea of a place on the 2016 ticket. He just recently has canceled a trip to Iowa in a show of his seriousness about New Hampshire. But, you know, there is the danger that he could be seen as someone who's a bit of an office shopper, you know, who's just looking for a seat to run for.
Well, let's move on now to news here in Massachusetts, and that has to do with the minimum wage, because yesterday House Speaker Robert DeLeo proposed increasing the state minimum wage to $10.50. He proposed doing it in three steps, but that is 50 cents less than a proposal from the Senate that came out much earlier. So, John, let's first start with you before we dive into a lot of the details of what the House Speaker has to say. Do you see any possible room for consensus between the House and the Senate in Massachusetts regarding raising the minimum wage?
Well, I can give them a way to solve this. Go to 1075 or play Yahtzee for it. either one. But I think that you've got a governor who wants to sign an increase in the minimum wage. You've got two chambers that want to increase the minimum wage. I don't see how this doesn't get done.
Okay. Well, Speaker DeLeo's proposal also ties the minimum wage increase to reforms of the state unemployment insurance laws, and that's been a move that's long been called for by the business community. We've got a little tape here of Robert DeLeo at the speech he made yesterday.
It is a careful balancing act, and one that involves improving conditions for workers at the bottom of our wage scale while creating a climate that permits businesses to create jobs.
Okay, and the speaker gave this speech at the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce, their frequent breakfast, so speaking before a business community there, and he got a pretty good reception. Here's Paul Guzzi, Chamber President.
In order to create good jobs, we need an environment here that encourages A, those businesses that are here, and B, all of those businesses that we want to come here. So this is an important set of issues.
So, Jim, let me turn back to you. What are your first thoughts on lots of discussion from all corners, it seems, about minimum wage in Massachusetts?
Right. It certainly seems that there's momentum now behind raising the minimum wage. The question remains how to do it, and you know, the Senate and the governor would like to index it to inflation in the out years. The speaker's plan did not do that. He threw in the unemployment insurance. That's sort of a sop to businesses. So his is more would be viewed as more business friendly. The plan sort of preferred by the governor and by the Senate is a little bit more. This is a little reductive, but you could call it more pro-worker. So it's just a little dance that they're going to have to do over the next couple months. And eventually, I think they'll come to some sort of, like John said, maybe it's a 1075 thing.
So you do see an agreement eventually. Do you think they can do it before Governor Patrick leaves office?
I think there's an impetus to do that. I think they would probably want to get it done before the election, something that maybe they could campaign on. And also would sort of give whichever Democratic candidate is running against the Republican a little bit to campaign on as well.
Mm. And John, this is yet another issue in which there's a lot of national discussion, which is being reflected here in Massachusetts. I mean, President Obama has been stumping around the nation practically to increase the federal minimum wage to $10.10. Do you think that has a lot to do with the increased momentum we're seeing here in the state?
I think that has a lot to do with it. And I think that when you look at surveys, I mean, there's overwhelming support for increasing the minimum wage. You look at the national surveys, Gallup had it at 71% last March, and then it had it at 76% in November. So it just keeps going up. Here's a really interesting number. NBC Wall Street Journal poll found 88% of Democrats surveyed said they'd be more likely to vote for a candidate who supported a hike in the minimum wage. Mm-hmm. So in an election year with a lot of Democratic support, with a ballot question potentially looming, there's been a ballot initiative certified that could go in November. I think they want to get out in front of this and use it to their advantage.
Mm. Let's move on and talk about the Boston Marathon, 118th Boston Marathon, just a few weeks away. And, of course, the big theme this year is security. Earlier this week, public safety officials announced a new list of measures designed to keep runners and viewers safe. It'll include twice as many police as before, more surveillance camera, bomb-sniffing dogs, restrictions on backpacks, coolers, and containers, and among other measures. Here's Massachusetts Emergency Management Director Kurt Schwartz.
The safety and security plan this year is comprehensive, much more comprehensive than last year, and there will be a significant increase in the number of police officers and other public safety personnel deployed. We are confident that the overall experience of runners and spectators will not be impacted, and that all will enjoy a fun, festive, family-oriented day.
John, initial thoughts from you. I mean, obviously heightened security, certainly understandable given what happened last year, but a fun, festive, family-oriented day, or are we verging toward a lockdown here?
I hope it's a fun, festive day in the tradition of the Boston Marathon. They're talking about 1 million people coming, which is about twice as many as normally come. They have twice as many police officers and National Guard out there as they normally have. I think one of the smart things they've done is to publicize this so widely. I think that that can be a strategic deterrent for anybody who might be thinking of doing something. The more publicity they get, the more news coverage they get, the more it seems like it would be a sort of an insurmountable test to go out and do something like happened last year.
Sure. Jim, what's your take on the response by public safety officials here?
I think they are sort of adopting a kitchen sink strategy, and I think they have to with the bombings last year. There are a lot of questions, and we had a story about how there are these incomplete national security reviews of what actually happened and how this could have been prevented when you have these apparently lone wolf actors like the Tsarnaevs. I think public officials are and safety officials are right to be as vigilant as possible. One thing that the political side to it is you've sort of got this war going on right now between Congressman Keating and Mayor Walsh about the date and locale of a House Committee on Homeland Security hearing. Walsh has sort of pushed back against Keating's effort to hold it in Boston just before the anniversary, and Keating has gone to our paper and others to talk about the inappropriateness of this. We're getting to a point now where there's enough distance from the event itself where politics is starting to work back into it, and before it was a sort of a nonpartisan response, and I think now you're starting to see a little bit of infighting and turf protection on the issue.
Well, Jim, you mentioned some unanswered questions about the bombings last year. Your paper ran a really thoughtful front page story on this. It began this way: nearly a year after the bombings, multiple security investigations remain bogged down, leaving unanswered questions about missed signals and communications breakdowns. What are the big sort of questions that need to be answered at this point, Jim?
Well, I think, I mean, this is just my own take on it. I think we want to know what could have been done, what sort of preventative measures could have been taken prior to the bombing that we could take now to prevent something like this happening again, whether it's here or someplace else. What did we miss? What did the FBI miss? Were the intelligence communities, and we saw this after 9/11, what we found out was that the intelligence agencies weren't talking to each other, that there was a lot of information out there that could have indicated something like this was coming, but because the agencies didn't share information, it was never really synthesized. So if there's something alarming like that, we want to know about it. And this is sort of a good way to go back and plumb what happened and what the various agencies did and how they cooperated with each other.
Yeah, John, I mean, do you have a sort of number one question that needs to still be answered
out there? One of the reasons Marty Walsh is pushing back so hard on this is because the Boston Police Department has a lot of questions to answer, too. There's been virtually no accountability. And as I think the Globe piece pointed out, an MBTA police officer, Richard Donahue, got shot by friendly fire during the pursuit of the Tsarnaevs. So I think there's a lot of accountability still out there to be sort of gathered up and presented to the public. And I think it's not happening. The Globe editorial called Marty Walsh's activity around this incoherent meddling, and I think that's pretty tough language from the Globe. But I think that he is going to be seen on the wrong side of this.
Well, finally, gentlemen, let's move on to the latest on the Department of Children and Families, which, of course, has come under a great deal of scrutiny following the disappearance of the 5-year-old Fitchburg boy, Jeremiah Oliver, who was under DCF supervision. A state commission progress report by the Child Welfare League of America was released just yesterday, calling for better supervision of social workers and also advising DCF to require that its electronic files include a photo of every child who enters the agency's care. So here's some reaction from State Secretary of Health and Human Services, John Polonowicz.
We're pleased that the interim report is out. It has a number of good recommendations. And with the support of the SUP, that came out yesterday, the supplemental budget, we've already done some work to enhance our staffing and to begin the process of bringing new technology into the department.
So, John, let me start with you. Technology and staffing, these are very concrete things that can be acted upon. But what about the deeper problems at DCF? There, I didn't see any major suggestions for structural changes, changes in management priorities, things like that.
Yeah, that's one of the things that's curious. I mean, taking a photo of every child that comes into your care seems to me to be pretty, you know, DCF 101. Mm-hmm. So you have to wonder about what they're thinking and their whole approach to this. But this particular report said we're going to hold off on any changes in the in upper management and administration until we're done with our report. There's two reads on that. One is, so, and they say it's for the sake of stability. So you have stability and incompetence on the one hand, or you have instability and maybe somebody who actually knows what they're doing on the other hand. So that's one thing, and the question of whether this the Child Welfare League of America is actually a little too cozy with some of the DCF right. people like Olga Roche.
Jim, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, one thing that jumped out to me from that story is that DCF went public, I think, for the first time with the fact that they are failing their own policy, which is to hold a medical screening for every child within a week after DCF gains custody of that child. And then they follow up, they're supposed to follow up with a more comprehensive exam within 30 days. And something like only 3/4 of the children are receiving that treatment. It just seems like the problems at DCF run so deep where they're failing to abide by their own policies, which in the first place may not be sufficient. I think at some point there's going to be an answerability issue here.
Right.
How far up it goes, I don't know.
Well, on that point, let me just briefly ask both of you. I mean, the thing that sticks with me is, yes, this is a preliminary report, and we'll see more recommendations later. But is there any likelihood that the state will actually follow through, especially on some of the tougher changes that may be suggested down the line? I mean, reports are easy, but actual change is very hard, John.
Yeah, no, I think that you're going to have someone who really scrutinizes this agency on a regular basis to have any really systemic change there. I think that there's a question of money, there's a question of competence, and then there's a question of accountability. And I think that without some serious oversight from some serious adult supervision, I think that you would have to wonder whether DCF is actually going to turn this around.
Jim, your thoughts?
I think John's right. It's when you're dealing with children, and these are, you know, the society's most vulnerable and in many cases helpless individuals, there's going to be the pressure to take some serious concrete and you know, like I said, there's going to need to be some answerability.
Mm. Well, finally today, it's time for our hubbubs, and those are the stories that didn't make it to top of mind but nevertheless deserve a little light shined on them. And Jim, do you want to start?
Sure. I think one of the things that this year the St. Patrick's Day Parade has gotten so much attention that maybe a little bit lost in the shuffle is going to be the breakfast, which for the first time is going to be hosted by a woman, a black woman, a state senator, for the first time someone from outside of South Boston, and Linda Dorsinafori, and I think it'll be interesting to see, you know, the breakfast has sort of declined over the last couple of years. If she can inject new life into the breakfast and make it a more politically relevant event again.
And she'll be having the Prime Minister of Ireland as one of
That's
her
right.
guests as well. John, your hubbub.
Well, my hubbub is the Boston Public Library got some love from the New York Times this week. They wrote a piece on the Boston on the Central Copley Square Library doing the $16 million renovation. I should say Bella English wrote a piece about this back in December, but the Times had something new, which was they're emphasizing the children's library, tweens and teens. Teen Central, according to the Times, is to become what is known as a HOMAGO space, which stands for hang out, mess around, geek out. None of which, by the way, I'm authorized to do in a public library. However, it's going to have the vibe of an industrial loft, a sort of eco-urban chic in the children's library, and there may be retail in the lobby. There may be all kinds of stuff that's going on. So a lot of exciting details in the Times this week.
What if you want to go and you're not a tween or a teen? That sounds like a cool space.
It sounds like a great space, but I think there's probably going to either be a cover charge or some kind of guard.
Yeah. Anthony.
All right. Well, my cover story and Jim O'Sullivan, I guess great minds think alike. I had sort of picked up on the St. Patrick's Day breakfast in South Boston as well as my hubbub, but I'll just sort of put this little exclamation point on it. Meghna mentioned that the Prime Minister of Ireland is coming, and what's sort of funny about this is listeners may have heard about this little dust-up. City Council President Bill Linehan wanted to host that breakfast, but he sort of lost the argument, and it's going to be State Senator Linda Dorsey-Nofori. So he decided to accept an invitation instead to celebrate St. Paddy's Day in Ireland. Lucky him. Off he goes. We won't say anything about sour grapes. Oops, I guess I just did. But here's the kicker. So Bill Linehan goes to Ireland, and I love it that the Prime Minister of Ireland is coming to the St. Patrick St. Paddy's Day breakfast in South Boston. So sort of a story of
Boston's the next parish west, as they say over there. Right?
There we go. Yeah. True. It's sort of the St. Paddy's Day breakfast is a transatlantic game of musical chairs. I sort of enjoyed that.
I think it's a fair trade, too.
Okay, so finally, my hubbub has to do with the fact that today is Pi Day, everybody. So who remembers the digits of pi?
Oh,
3.2 something.
3.149.
I think Jim O'Sullivan is our math winner, almost.
That would be a shock to my math teachers.
3.14159, yes. And then infinite number of digits after that, right? Yes, so, of course,
I was thinking
which
apple
we don't have time for.
And it's International Pi Day today because today is March 14th, and which makes me think that next year's Pi Day is going to be even cooler because it'll be March 14th, 2015. But I wanted to just point out that that at MIT they're taking this very seriously because at 3:14 p.m. today they started a pie eating, pie baking, pie recitation contest. You can even get a pie thrown in your face, but photographed in one of by MIT's super high speed cameras. And this evening they're going to be telling the incoming class of 2018, I believe, exactly who's going to be in that incoming class. But I also wanted to point out that regarding the recitation of pi, unfortunately, the Chinese once again beat out the Americans because the Guinness Book of World Records is held by a Chinese chemistry student who, over the course of 24 hours, recited all the digits of pi out to 67,000 decimal places.
You should be geeking out at the Boston Public Library.
That's why I'm so excited about it. Yeah. Well, happy Pi Day, everybody. And with that note, John Carroll, communications professor at Boston University and the man behind the CampaignOutsider.com blog. Great to have you as always, John.
Always great to be here.
And Jim O'Sullivan, political reporter for the Boston Globe and politics editor for Boston.com and today's math winner. Jim, thanks so much.
Thanks very much.
And stay with us. Still to come, Walter Kern on his new book, Blood Will Out, the true story of a murder, a mystery, and a masquerade. It tells the story of the man who once went by the name Clark Rockefeller. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.